Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, September 5th, 2020. Front page. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Agency seeks to deny some habitat protections. By Matthew Brown, Associated Press. Billings, Montana. A Trump administration proposal released Friday would allow the government to deny habitat protections for endangered animals and plants in areas that would see greater economic benefits from being developed. A change critics said could open lands to more energy development and other activities. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials described the proposal as giving more deference to local governments when they want to build things like schools and hospitals. But the proposal indicates that exemptions from habitat protections would be considered for a much broader array of developments, including at the request of private companies that lease federal lands or have permits to use them. Government-issued leases and permits can allow energy development, grazing, recreation, logging, and other commercial uses of public lands. It's the latest move by the Trump administration in a years-long effort to repeal regulations across government that has broadly changed how the Endangered Species Act gets used. Other steps under Trump to scale back species rules included lifting blanket protections for animals newly listed as threatened, setting cost estimates for saving species, and a pending proposal to restrict what areas fit under the definition of habitat. Governors from 22 Western states and Pacific territories, in a Thursday letter to the Wildlife Service, demanded more say in how habitat gets defined, since that decision could further restrict what land and waterways can be protected. Wildlife advocates say the administration's approach has elevated natural resource extraction and commercial development over the protection of sites that are home to dwindling populations of endangered species. Animals that could be affected by the latest change include the struggling lesser prairie chicken, a grasslands bird found in 5 states in the south central U.S., and the rare dunes sagebrush lizard that lives among the oil fields of western Texas and eastern New Mexico, wildlife advocates said. Friday's proposal and the habitat definition offered in July were triggered by a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving a highly endangered southern frog, the dusky gopher frog. In that case, a unanimous court faulted the government over how it designated critical habitat for the 3.5-inch long, 8.9-centimeter long frogs that survive in just a few ponds in Mississippi. The ruling came after a timber company, Weyerhaeuser, had sued when land it owned in Louisiana was designated as critical. The new proposal would require federal officials to consider factors such as economic or employment losses when making habitat decisions. That includes decisions affecting federal land for which private companies have permits or leases, such as for drilling, grazing, logging, or other development. Those areas could be carved out from protections by the Secretary of Interior, so long as the exclusion of a particular area does not cause extinction of a species, Fish and Wildlife officials wrote. Agency Director Aurelia Skipwith said in a statement that the proposal would provide greater transparency for the public, improve consistency and predictability for stakeholders affected by ESA, Endangered Species Act, determinations, and stimulate more effective conservation. But the former director of the Federal Wildlife Service during the Clinton administration, Jamie Rappaport Clark, said the change, if finalized, was sure to harm species on the edge of extinction. This new proposal puts a heavy thumb on the scale in favor of developers and industry, said Clark, who now heads the advocacy group Defenders of Wildlife. Investigation. Autopsy. Inmate swallows plastic bag. By Caitlin Randall. CRANDLE at MRT.com. An autopsy of Wallace Tremaine Howell, the man who died at the Ector County Detention Center in June, found that Howell had a torn and knotted plastic baggie in his small intestine. Howell was tased and pepper sprayed several times by jail staff after allegedly getting in an altercation with another inmate, according to a custodial death report. An autopsy determined he had several puncture and burn marks consistent with being tased six times in the span of 2 minutes. The Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office ruled Howell's cause of death was an accidental meth overdose. A toxicology report found Howell tested positive for methamphetamine, amphetamine, and an antihistamine. An Ector County grand jury on Tuesday declined to indict the employees who were involved in Howell's death. District Attorney Bobby Bland, however, said in a statement that he believed jail staff had used excessive force when confronting Howell. The autopsy found multiple bruises on Howell's face and extremities. The plastic baggie was found in the small intestine, about 20 centimeters from the stomach, according to an autopsy report. The report did not state if any contents were recovered from inside the baggie. The subject of Howell's autopsy was addressed during a press conference Friday morning following a protest at the Ector County Courthouse. Lawyers for Howell's family said they had ordered an independent autopsy for which they had not yet received results. "We don't trust law enforcement auditing other law enforcement agencies," said Dallas-based attorney Justin Moore, adding they would be filing a civil suit. The lawyer said they received about 8 minutes of video from the district attorney's office, which corroborated Bland's statement that excessive force had been used by jail staff. They declined to provide further details on the footage, saying Howell's family had not yet been told about the contents of the video. When asked about the plastic baggie found during Howell's autopsy, the lawyers raised the possibility the bag had torn because of force used by the jail employees. About 40 protesters marched from Noel Heritage Plaza to the Ector County Courthouse Friday morning. The protest remained peaceful, apart from a small group of counter-protesters standing across the street from the courthouse, open carrying long rifles. Arlana Davis, a protester with those at the courthouse, at one point approached the men carrying rifles. "I asked them if they were there to support the family, and they said no. They were there in case something were to happen. They'd be ready to take care of it," she said. When Davis asked what they meant by that, she said the men told her they were there because of what all the black people are doing around the country. Davis said she told police officers standing nearby what the men had said, but the officers told her nothing could be done because the men were expressing their Second Amendment rights. Nation's rig count rises by 2. Texas is down 1. By Mella McEwen, MCEWEN at MRT.com. Drilling activity, if not significantly along the road to recovery, continues to give indications it has at least reached bottom after more than 20 weeks of decline and 14 consecutive record lows. Baker Hughes, the oilfield services firm, reported Friday 256 oil and gas rigs at work in the U.S., up 2 from the previous week, and above the most recent record low of 244 set in mid-August. Until reaching bottom last month, the rig count had fallen over 60% since March, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, shuttering economies and wiping out oil demand. Until then, Baker Hughes, which has issued weekly rig counts since the 1940s, said the record low was 404 rigs in May 2016. This week, there were 181 rigs drilling for oil, up one from the previous week, and 72 rigs seeking natural gas, unchanged for the week. A year ago, there were 870 rigs at work nationwide, 630 more than this year. Texas remained the most active producing state nationally, though it dropped one rig to 106, 332 rigs below the 438 at work statewide this time last year. New Mexico was one of two producing states to add rigs, rising one to 47. Louisiana added three rigs for a total of 37. The Permian Basin remains the most active region in the nation with almost half the nation's rigs, 125, unchanged for the week, and 302 rigs lower than the 427 a year ago. Eddy County, New Mexico remains the most active county in the Permian with 26 rigs, down two for the week. Lee County recorded the largest increase in the Permian, adding three rigs for 21 this week. Martin County also reported 21 rigs, down one for the week. Midland County reported 12 rigs at work within county lines, down one, and Loving County reported 10 rigs for a second consecutive week. Energy. Oil prices fall below $40 a barrel by Milla McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Crude oil prices fell below $40 Friday for the first time in a month, ending a week that saw prices decline 4 out of 5 trading days. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange tumbled $1.60 to close at $39.77 a barrel, down from $42.61 at Monday's close. Bloomberg attributed the decline to this week's sharp sell-off in equities and a stronger dollar heightening concerns about demand. The upcoming Labor Day holiday brings to an end a summer driving season that was, at best, lackluster amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Bloomberg said. Crude prices are off to a weak start this month amid pandemic flare-ups in various parts of the world that threaten a sustained recovery in oil consumption at a time the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies are returning oil to the market, according to Bloomberg. The news agency quoted Russia's oil minister saying demand has returned to 90% of pre-COVID levels, but limited travel and work-from-home arrangements are slowing down the recovery. Natural gas prices rose 10 cents Friday, but still posted a loss for the week, unable to overcome Tuesday's 10-cent drop and Wednesday's 4-cent loss. Prices closed at $2.59 per MCF Friday, down from $2.63 at Monday's close. Adrian Lara, senior oil and gas analyst at Global Data, said in a statement that oil markets are on the right track, if at a slow pace. Gasoline demand has seen a favorable trend since early April, but has not sustained above the 9 million barrel level, Lara wrote. There is at least 400,000 barrels of volume not supplied that still accounts as demand destroyed when compared to demand in August last year, and around 50% less demand for jet fuel, which is not looking to recover anytime soon. In a way, the upward trend has become clearer in the last 4 months, but it appears to have plateaued. With respect to crude oil, last week was unusual because of the disruptions caused by Hurricane Laura. Output was reduced by 1.1 million barrels per day, mainly due to shut-ins of output in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, where at the strongest period of the hurricane, almost half of the offshore platforms were evacuated, leading to an approximately 84% loss in offshore crude production. In relation to this drop in production, crude oil stocks experienced a relatively high withdrawal of 9.3 million barrels, pointing to a compensation from the reduced supply due to the hurricane. Still, it is expected for offshore crude production to be brought back online, and inventory withdrawals, when occurring, are expected to average levels seen during previous weeks of around 4.5 million barrels. WTI price has remained above $40 per barrel since early July and surpassed $43 per barrel during the last week of August, but has not been able to breach the $45 per barrel mark. Cuts in domestic production are behind the price rebound from the levels below $20 per barrel seen in April and May. Weekly signals of weaker or stronger demand for transportation fuels, in particular gasoline, are now a main driver affecting WTI price. Indeed, last week's lower supplied volumes of gasoline and lower crude demand from refiners negatively impacted WTI. A level below $45 is still considered challenging for many U.S. producers, especially for companies operating in shale plays across the country.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, September 6, 2020. Section A. Counsel, manager to decide on separation terms. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. City Manager Courtney Sharp turned in his letter of resignation on Tuesday, setting in motion the need for the Midland City Council to execute a separation and release agreement. The council will vote Tuesday to authorize the mayor to execute the agreement between the city and Sharp. The agreement calls for Sharp's employment to end at 5 p.m. on September 18th. It also calls for a severance payment of $152,979.84. That includes 6 months' base salary and longevity pay, $30,806.18 in unused sick leave and vacation, and $9,500 for 6 months of insurance coverage. The agreement, which Sharp signed on Wednesday, also states that the terms of this agreement are to the mutual benefit of the parties and the employee, when neither of them asked to resign nor resigned in lieu of termination. Sharp, in his letter of resignation to the mayor and city council, states that he is proud of his accomplishments during his 12 years as the city manager, and at this time I feel it is best that I step away from the role of city manager. Sharp also noted that during the last year, I have leaned heavily on the assistant city managers and city staff to ensure that the city of Midland was able to successfully carry on. Sharp has dealt with health issues during that period. I truly believe we have the best employees on staff, Sharp wrote. Sharp came to Midland when it was on the verge of one of its most explosive periods of growth. Midland's population increased from around 111,000 in 2010 to 145,000 this year, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. His office carried out council initiatives to build the 59-mile pipeline to T-Bar Ranch, tens of millions in road projects, and the tens of millions spent in infrastructure improvements to allow for growth in Northeast Midland. Councilman Scott Difford noted that Sharp, who came to Midland from the East Texas city of Mount Pleasant, was the right hire at the right time for the city, and that he brought a different management style to City Hall and got more out of his employees than his predecessor. Sharp's office has overseen the most significant efforts to redevelop downtown in decades, with the building of the Bush Convention Center, the adjacent Centennial Park, a new municipal court building, and a pair of downtown parking garages. City leaders also spent about $10 million in upgrades to the city's water parks and millions more on a new Dennis the Menace Park in central Midland and auxiliary fields at the Scarber Sports Complex. We have been working with Courtney in conversation and planning for his next step in life and career, as well as the city's next steps and needs for the future, ultimately settling on mutually beneficial directions with our desire to bless him for his 12 years of amazing service to Midland and our best wishes and blessings in his new journey, Midland Mayor Patrick Payton wrote Thursday. The following is a letter Sharp sent out to the City of Midland employees this past week. to my City of Midland family. I am happy to announce my retirement from the City of Midland effective September 18, 2020. Over the past 12 years, I have made Midland my home and the employees of the City of Midland an extension of my family. Professionally, I have experienced the greatest growth of my career in the Permian Basin alongside each of you. Personally, I have raised my family and established friendships that will last a lifetime. I appreciate the hard work and dedication that each of you have given me as your city manager and, most importantly, the citizens of Midland. As I begin to write the next chapter of my life, I will always cherish the memories that were made here in Midland. Thank you for your service. It was a pleasure working with each and every one of you. Courtney Sharp. Education. Reports. Lee makes naming committees list of five. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. Some version of Lee is in three of the five names being considered by committee members for the renaming of Robert E. Lee High School and the Freshman High School. According to two social media postings from separate members on the Citizens Renaming Committee, created to rename the high school and freshman school, the list was cut down to five names last week. They are Midland Carver Lee, Tall City High School, Basin High School, Lee High School, and Legacy of Equality and Excellence. Midland Carver Lee had 15 of the 23 votes from the committee. Each member was allowed to vote for five names, according to the Facebook page of John Norman, who is a committee member. Tall City High School had 12, Basin High School 11, Lee High School 11, and Legacy of Equality and Excellence 10. The multiple social media posts indicated that the five names will be narrowed down to three this week. The committee's co-chair, Shannon Lowe, previously told the Reporter-Telegram that the committee will present three names to district leaders, who will present those to the board. The top recommendation will be the name that received the most votes. In today's Viewpoint section, there are opinion articles from committee members discussing the use of Lee in renaming the school. There has been conversation about whether to keep Lee or L-E-E, all in caps, in the name, with those on both sides of the issue having been heard in rallies around the city or in opinion articles in the Reporter-Telegram. Whatever we believe about the man himself, Robert E. Lee, and icons of the Confederacy, such as the Confederate flag, rebels, and the song Dixie, are not quaint reminders of the antebellum South, Todd A. Brown wrote. Instead, they have become symbols of the brutality and cruelty of slavery and the Jim Crow era. We cannot separate these icons from this reality. Words and symbols are powerful. They mean something. We do not have the option to determine what a symbol means. Symbols are messages that communicate something specific. Sarah Hale took a different stance in her opinion article. It's hard for me to sit in a room that is questioning the equality of a name, but devaluing the equality of a choice. We all have a choice, and I will always vote for the majority if I am chosen to speak for them, she wrote. Various forms of Midland Lee were by far the majority in every poll, survey, and discussion reviewed. If we don't value a majority, I fear the direction of our community is heading. In July, the board voted to rename Robert E. Lee High School and the Freshman School with the same name. It also stated a committee would be formed and then meet to discuss submitted names and make at least one and no more than three recommendations to the superintendent. The superintendent would then present those recommendations to the board for final approval no later than October 19th. Should three recommendations go to the district leaders, it is guaranteed one of those will include Lee. Weekly COVID cases down 70% from the start of August. 123 cases this past week are the lowest since mid-June. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. The number of coronavirus cases this past week was down 21.65% week over week and down more than 70% since the beginning of August. The 123 cases provided more good news for medical officials, as this week was the third straight with fewer than 200 cases. It also marked the fourth straight week of declines since numbers of cases reached 414 August 2nd through 8th. There were another six deaths, which was one more than last week, and brought the total number of COVID-19-related deaths involving Midland County residents to 73 during the pandemic. The statistics from Friday show there have been 1,776 cases recoveries during the pandemic and 1,335 active cases. During the pandemic, there have been 3,362 total cases. 1 year later, will Midland-Odessa shootings impact gun laws? By Eleanor Dearman, El Paso Times. A year after her brother was killed in a Midland-Odessa shooting spree, Carla Byrne is still waiting for stricter background checks on the purchase of guns. Texas officials have said the man who killed her brother and six others in the August 2019 mass shooting obtained a weapon through a private sale, despite having previously failed a background check. My brother, Joseph Griffith, had a life that was stolen from him, but I know with 100% certainty that I cannot sit idly by and just be sad. I can't watch on the news any more kids being killed in schools, any more people being slaughtered in churches and synagogues. Byrne is one in a coalition of people across the state calling for stricter gun laws in Texas and the country in the aftermath of mass shootings, including the one in Midland-Odessa a year ago. The push is sure to face an uphill climb in the state that has resisted gun safety measures in the past. On August 31, 2019, a gunman carried out a shooting rampage that started on Interstate 20 between Odessa and Midland after a traffic stop and continued for more than 10 miles. Seven people were killed in the shooting and more than two dozen wounded. Three police officers were injured. The victims included a 17-month-old girl who survived and a 29-year-old postal worker who was killed when the shooter commandeered her USPS truck, a teen shopping for a car, and a truck driver, Raul Garcia, 35, of El Paso. The gunman was eventually shot and killed by police officers. Law enforcement officials told the Associated Press and ABC News that a person-to-person sale allowed him to buy the AR-style rifle used in the shooting. A law enforcement official told the AP that a mental health issue caused the gunman to fail a federal background check in 2014. Not only did the Odessa gunman have a criminal history, he also previously failed a gun purchase background check in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott said in a tweet in the days after the shooting, and he didn't go through a background check for the gun he used in Odessa. We must keep guns out of criminals' hands. Griffith's family and the family of 15-year-old Lila Hernandez, who was also killed in the shooting, are suing for $1 million in damages, the arms manufacturer, Anderson Arms, and the Lubbock man, Marcus Brazil, who allegedly sold the gun to the shooter. The lawsuit was filed August 28th in district court in Ector County. The Ector County District Clerk's Office said Brazil and Anderson Manufacturing did not yet have attorneys on the record. The petition states that Griffith, 40, was driving his wife and children to take pictures when the shooter pulled up next to their vehicle. The next thing the children saw was an AR-15 pointed directly at them. In the aftermath of the shooting and the mass shooting weeks before in El Paso, there were calls for action from Texas leadership. Roundtables were held and committees created for discussions on how to address a mass shooting. Governor Greg Abbott also issued a series of executive orders that, among other things, focus on bringing suspicious activity reports to the attention of law enforcement. But in the past year, little has been done in the way of passing laws related to gun violence, despite calls for a special session. The fact is that no law can pass unless the legislature's in session, and the governor is the only one who can call a special session, said Gil Switzer, executive director of firearm safety group Texas Gun Sense. Switzer is expecting progress to be made in the coming legislative session that's set to convene in January. I did see some light bulbs go off of legislators thinking, "Oh, that makes sense," Switzer said of the House and Senate committees formed to address mass violence. "I think people realized that there were some common sense legislation that doesn't infringe on anybody's rights about guns that can save lives." Those hearings have gone by the wayside amid the coronavirus pandemic. But in recent weeks, the House committee has solicited written input from experts and members of the public in lieu of in-person testimony. One measure that could be proposed is background checks for stranger-to-stranger gun sales, a measure Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has expressed support for. "When I talk to gun owners, NRA members, and voters, people don't understand why we allow strangers to sell guns to total strangers when they have no idea if the person they're selling the gun to could be a felon, could be someone who's getting a gun to go commit a crime, or could be a potential mass shooter, or someone who has serious mental issues," Patrick told the Dallas Morning newspaper in a September 2019 article. Patrick's office did not respond to emails seeking comment. "There will likely be a bill filed related to universal background checks," said Switzer. "Under federal law, unlicensed gun sellers can currently sell firearms without conducting background checks, according to the Giffords Law Center. A strengthened background check bill in Texas could include some expectations. We understand there could be exceptions for grandma giving her grandson her antique rifle. It is this stranger-to-stranger issue that concerns us." While some are pushing for stricter gun laws, for Rachel Malone, Texas Director of Gun Owners of America, it's important people be able to carry a firearm for self-defense. "The state legislature cannot control the actions of people who are determined to break the law. What the Texas legislature should be focused on is encouraging and enabling honest Texans to be able to defend themselves." Asked about the idea of stranger-to-stranger background checks, Malone said it's an example of a law that's proposed to keep criminals from getting guns, but criminals will find other means of obtaining weapons. Malone also expressed concerns about people mistakenly being denied the ability to purchase a gun. On the federal level, House members have pushed for expanded background checks. The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives in February passed a bill that would prohibit most person-to-person firearm transfers unless a background check is done, closing a potential loophole permitting the transfer of firearms without a background check at gun shows or between individuals. The bill, H.R. 8, sponsored by Representative Mike Thompson from California, has been stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. "My heart feels convicted by my God to speak out against this for other people," Byrne said in an August 28th news conference outside the Ector County Courthouse. "We, as a family, have come to our moment of great refusal. We refuse to sit back while Congress sits on H.R. 8, legislation that would have provided universal background checks on all gun sales, including and especially private." Byrne, who said she is a gun owner and supports the Second Amendment, disputed the argument that criminals will still find a way to get a gun, even with the tighter background checks. "People say, you know what? A criminal is going to get a gun anyway." "Yes, he or she will, but then we can prosecute the person that sold the gun to them without a background check. That's what we're fighting for." Her determination increased as she asked what it would take for people to say, "This is enough." "I am irreparably and profoundly changed," Byrne said, "and I would ask that those of you who it has not happened to, that you would have enough empathy and enough courage to stand up and say, this is wrong."
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, September 7th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "New Mexico Researchers Seek to Map Delaware Aquifers," by Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Carlsbad Current Argus. The Delaware Basin serves as one of the most prolific areas for oil and gas extractions in the U.S. and potentially the world. But alongside fossil fuel development, industries such as agriculture, mining, and recreation define the desert region in southeast New Mexico. And that takes a lot of water. That's why conservationists and state agencies worked for years to better understand the delicate karstic aquifers in the Delaware Basin so they can better manage the sensitive groundwater supplies where such resources are scarce. To do so, the New Mexico Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department's Oil Conservation Division, OCD, partnered with the New Mexico Bureau of Geology and Mineral Resources at New Mexico Tech to map the aquifer systems throughout the basin, creating 3D models that could provide a better understanding of the complex, yet often unseen, underground water system. The project was funded through a $394,967 grant and will run from April 2020 to June 2022, involving 9 hydrologists from the Bureau and 2 database specialists. Layla Sturgis, Aquifer Mapping Program Manager at the Bureau, said the project will expand on modeling of the Pecos Slope region by expanding mapping to extend south to the Texas state line using ArcGIS, or Geographic Information Systems. The Aquifer Mapping Program is working towards mapping all of the major aquifers in New Mexico in 3D, using ArcGIS, Sturgis said. We recently completed a model of the Pecos Slope region. The new Delaware Basin model will extend that model south to the state line. How will it work? The mapping project was focused on recording the thickness, extent, and volume of shallow aquifers in the Greater Delaware Basin, including the Capitan Reef freshwater aquifer north of Carlsbad. It will extend to the Texas border from the Pecos River and could be further expanded, if successful, to include the Rustler and Dewey Lake or Santa Rosa aquifers. The information resulting from the project was intended to help better inform the Oil Conservation Division's regulations and permitting of oil and gas operations in the area. To create the framework for the project, researchers will use existing geologic and well information while analyzing more than 1,500 new geophysical well logs provided by the agency. Bureau scientists will use the initial modeling information to locate areas lacking data and target them for more research. The high density of data that the OCD well logs provide in this region allow us to troubleshoot our models and understand limitations we may face as we move into much more data-poor regions of the state, Sturgis said. To augment the existing data, the Bureau will conduct a multi-year field campaign, taking water level measurements in about 100 wells and water quality measurements in another 40. The water level data will help hydrologists better understand long-term impacts to aquifers of pumping, precipitation, and evaporation. Water quality data will help inform researchers on the level of groundwater recharge, the age of the water, flow directions, and the amount of water flow between aquifers. The 3D models will be used to determine boundaries between underwater fresh and saline water resources. Every drop is important. OCD Director Adrienne Sandoval said the information gained from the study will be valuable to agency in protecting water supplies and conserving resources while permitting uses such as oil and gas production. The Oil Conservation Division is committed to protecting our environmental resources, and collecting better data is one way to ensure we're working efficiently and in line with the realities on the ground, Sandoval said. The Aquifer Mapping Project will allow the OCD to better protect New Mexico's precious water resources and is a great example of state agencies partnering to accomplish ambitious goals. Sandy Wilkie, District Director of the Carlsbad Soil and Water Conservation District, said such projects are essential to creating a better understanding of the region's complex underground water systems. On the surface, Wilkie's agency worked to protect groundwater supplies by removing invasive species such as salt cedar African rue, which use more water than native grasses, and wildlife, and working to control erosion at rivers and streams in the area. The Delaware Basin is known for sensitive karstic aquifers that can become in danger of depletion, she said, in the arid climate of the southeast New Mexico, and as the water is needed by multiple industrial sectors. Any knowledge that we can have about our water systems and how everything is evolving is a good thing, Wilkie said. Every drop of water we have in southeast New Mexico is important. Anything we can do to better understand and utilize it is a good thing. She said the unique system can become taxed by various uses, from normal use by residents and their wells to larger industrial uses such as oil and gas. The possibility of a depleting aquifer is a concern for everyone, Wilkie said. We do have issues with farmers and ranchers whose wells have been impacted by activities downstream. These things are important to keep an eye on. To conserve the water resources of the area amid industrial development, Wilkie said all users must have a broad understanding of how they are being impacted and how their use impacts others. All the industries have to work together to understand the impact they have on each other, she said. Every industry is as important as the others. We're all intertwined. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This article is entitled Poll, First-Time Gun Buyers Fear Civil Unrest, by Elizabeth Thompson, Dallas Morning News. As protests continue across the country and President Donald Trump warns of rampant lawlessness should former Vice President Joe Biden win the election, gun owners are stocking up. In Texas, fear has been a motivation for first-time gun owners, according to a poll released Sunday by the Dallas Morning News and the University of Texas at Tyler. Just over a third of Texans polled say they own at least one gun. Some 17% of gun owners bought a gun within the past 90 days, and of those, more than half were first-time buyers. The pace picked up substantially in August. Most of the people who bought their own first gun this summer bought it in the past 2 weeks. Of the people who bought a gun in the past 14 days, 84% were buying for the first time. Almost half of the 1,150 Texas voters surveyed expect that the pandemic will lead to civil unrest. About a third own at least one gun. I think there is a general panic and unrest, said poll respondent Tony Ashcraft, owner of a gun center in Pearland. Demand by first-time gun owners began to spike in March, said Ashcraft, who said that in 6 years selling guns, he's never seen as many first-time buyers as in the past 6 months. There's no one flavor of humanity that comes in. A big panic is panic in everybody's mind. Everybody is worried, he said. The survey results bear that out. First-time gun owners favor Biden over Trump, in fact. The FBI has done over 1.5 million background checks for Texas gun buyers this year, more than in all of 2019, and with 4 months left in 2020. Bruce Jones of New Braunfels, a former school administrator, was one of the poll respondents who bought his first gun this year. After serving more than 20 years in the Army, Jones said he is comfortable using a weapon, but he never felt he needed one until he moved from New Jersey to Texas this year. He decided to buy a gun 5 months ago after seeing a man take out a gun and point it at a driver who cut him off on the highway. "I purchased because everyone else has got one," Jones said. "In case somebody tried to break into my house or injure my family, I've got to be able to protect myself." Since 1998, the FBI has recorded the highest number of background checks per day and per week in 2020. 8 of the 10 top weeks in the past 22 years were in 2020. Gun dealers surveyed by the National Shooting Sports Foundation estimated that 40% of their sales have been to first-time gun buyers this year. For those surveyed, fear of the presidential election's outcome was not a notable concern. But Ashcroft saw purchases skyrocket in March when the pandemic began, and another spike in June when racial tensions increased across the country. Since George Floyd's death at the hands of police in Minnesota at the end of May, there have been protests across the country calling for a racial reckoning, some of which grew violent. There were a record-breaking 4 million firearm background checks nationwide in June as the protests picked up. As a black man, Jones said there are extra complications to owning a gun. He said he keeps his weapon at home and he would be afraid to be pulled over by a police officer while he has a gun in the car. It's scary out there, Jones said. Not all weapon purchases were for self-defense. Steve Rahimian of Waco recently bought a vintage rifle for his collection of 12 firearms from the First and Second World Wars. For him, the rifle is more of a historical artifact than a weapon, but he had hoped to use it to qualify for the civilian marksmanship program, which requires passing a test showing competence with a firearm, so he can be eligible to buy more vintage weapons. None of these rifles are like an AR-15, Rahimian said, like high-capacity magazines or something like that. I don't think you're going to see most people going on a shooting rampage with a rifle from World War I. Ashcroft cautioned against buying a firearm out of panic, because buying is just the first step in being a responsible gun owner. The best thing that can happen to you if you own a gun and you know how to load it, you know how to unload it, you know where and when you can shoot it, you know how to store it, you know how to keep it safe, you know how to clean it, and you never have to use it to harm anybody else or defend yourself by taking someone else's life, Ashcroft said. That is the best scenario that can happen to you. This article is distributed by the Tribune Content Agency.
This is Trish reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. Crime. Lawyers seek new trial for death row inmate. Appeal for man convicted in Midland County focuses on prosecutor clerking for judge. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HEARSTNP.com. Lawyers for Clinton Young, who is on death row after being convicted of capital murder in Midland, won a new trial because they said one of the prosecutors in the 2003 trial was also working for the district judge involved in the trial. In an application for a writ of habeas corpus seeking relief from a judgment of death, Young's attorneys wrote that the trial judge, the late John Hyde of the 238th District Court, overseeing Young's conviction and death sentence, employed then Assistant District Attorney Ralph Petty as a judicial clerk, while Petty also represented the state at Young's trial and in the appeals process. Young was sentenced to death in 2003 after he was convicted in Hyde's court of the 2001 murders of Doyle Douglas and Samuel Petrie for the use of their vehicles. Douglas, 41, of Orr City, was killed near Longview. Petrie, 52, of Eastland, was kidnapped in his hometown and killed in an oil field near Midland, according to reports. The incidents occurred within a 48-hour period, according to Texas Department of Criminal Justice records. This is Young's fifth post-conviction writ of habeas corpus, according to the Midland County District Attorney's Office. Young was scheduled to be executed in 2017, but received a stay of execution a little more than a week ahead of that October date. The TDCJ website doesn't show that a subsequent execution date has been scheduled. While the trial took place in 2003, it wasn't until August of 2019 that the Midland County District Attorney's Office reported to Young's attorneys that Petty had been billing the district court judges for work he had been performing, while at the same time working for the district attorney's office as its primary lawyer in post-conviction writ of habeas corpus cases. The writ states that for approximately 17 years, Petty had billed the trial court and other Midland judges for tens of thousands of dollars of work as a judicial clerk, all the while he was working as a prosecutor, appearing in these courts, sometimes on the same cases he was working on as a judicial clerk. The Midland County District Attorney's Office filed a motion on August 22, 2019 to recuse itself. In September of that year, the Dawson County District Attorney was appointed as Attorney Pro Tem to act for the state in this matter. In the writ's claims for relief, the first claim is that the judicial bias and structural defect from the trial court's hiring of a prosecutor as a paid judicial clerk during Young's trial violated due process and the separation of powers. It states the trial judge paid Petty for work as a law clerk before, during, and after Young's trial. It stated the simultaneous role as a judicial clerk and prosecutor violated the state and federal separation of powers and the Texas Constitution. It stated that Petty, a member of the executive branch with the DA's office, was working as a member of the judicial branch, while Hyde authorized payments to him for his work as a judicial advisor or law clerk. It stated that the due process and separation of powers violations stemming from the trial's court arrangement with the prosecutor is a structural defect that warrants a new trial. In the statement of the case portion of the writ, it states that Hyde sought, in 2002, an advisory opinion from Midland County Attorney Russell Malm about Ralph Petty's receiving pay for work he did for district judges on post-conviction writs. The writ then says Malm states Mr. Petty's duties as an assistant district attorney do not include work on post-conviction writs, and that if a writ progresses to the stage that the involvement of the district attorney's office is necessary, another attorney within the department handles the case. The trial court disregarded Malm's advice, according to the writ. Petty did serve in a dual role as judicial clerk in cases where he was the prosecutor, including work on Young's case. The sole reason that Judge Hyde sought my advice was to determine whether the county auditor could approve additional payments to Mr. Petty beyond his salary, Malm told the Reporter-Telegram this weekend. This is different from the issues presented in Mr. Young's application for writ of habeas corpus. The second claim stated that Hyde was required to disqualify himself after hiring one of the prosecutors appearing against Young as a judicial clerk, rendering the trial court's judgment void and a nullity. According to the writ, Hyde hired Petty to work for the court on at least 20 separate cases during Young's trial proceeding. This arrangement, the words of the Midland County District Attorney's Office, made Petty a de facto law clerk of Judge Hyde during Young's trial, according to the writ. A third claim is that pervasive prosecutorial misconduct, including the authorization of a prosecutor to work for the trial court, warrants a new trial. The writ states, despite knowing of Petty's arrangement with the trial court at the time of Young's trial, leadership at the District Attorney's Office did not disclose Petty's simultaneous role until 2019. County Attorney Russell Malm's comments this past weekend about the advisory opinion Judge John Hyde sought in 2002. When Judge Hyde requested my opinion in 2002, it was not with regards to whether Mr. Petty performing work for the judges would create ethical issues or would cause due process or other issues with any criminal prosecution. It was solely with reference to a very limited question. That question was whether Mr. Petty, as a county attorney, could receive additional compensation for work he performed for district judges. Normally, the Texas Constitution prohibits a county employee from receiving additional compensation for work which he is already being compensated. My opinion was solely limited to this question and was based upon the facts I was presented with at the time. The sole reason that Judge Hyde sought my advice was to determine whether the county auditor could approve additional payments to Mr. Petty beyond his salary. This is different from the issues presented in Mr. Young's application for writ of habeas corpus. I had no further involvement with this issue after rendering my opinion and no knowledge of which individuals in the district attorney's office were working on the Clinton Young case. As that case is still active, I do not believe it would be appropriate for me to state whether my 2002 opinion would have been different if I was presented with a different set of facts at that time. Elections. Marquez seeks another term in MISD District 2 by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD board member Robert Marquez wants to finish what he started. The Lone Star governance work, the transition of the district into a system of great schools, and a continued positive outlook on what the district will become. They all define the first 4 years of the representative for District 2, generally Southeast and South Central Midland. Schools in the district include Franks Elementary, De Zavala Elementary, Midland High, South Elementary, Travis Elementary, and Midland Freshman. Marquez's opponent in November is Rachel Davis. I'm running again because we have started a great process, Marquez told the Reporter-Telegram. Of Lone Star governance, Marquez said, I'm proud that we have come together to unify with Lone Star governance. The Texas Education Agency states the purpose of Lone Star governance is to provide coaching and support through a continuous improvement framework for school governing teams that choose and commit to intensively focus on the objective to improve student outcomes. Of the system of great schools, Marquez said, the system of great schools definition will come from the community as it sets the system. The Texas Education reports that a system of great schools seeks to understand school performance and community demands and uses that information to make decisions about expanding what works, replacing what doesn't, and pursuing all possible options to create high-quality, best-fit schools. Marquez, who is employed with Diamondback Energy, has worked in the industry for more than 3 decades. His children are Midland ISD graduates, and his grandchildren currently attend MISD schools. His wife is an MISD teacher, and stepdaughter is a counselor. The Air Force veteran said he wants equity in facilities, the elimination of portables, a district that pays its teachers salaries that are in line with those in the Metroplex, and a district that is proactive in providing affordable housing options for teachers when rents spike. My main goal is to improve student outcomes, Marquez said. If we improve student outcomes, the academic stuff takes care of itself. That is the most important thing on my mind as a board member. The community and business side are asking for well-educated people to work in the industries that exist in Midland. The goal for the next 4 years is to stay focused on that and adjust to other needs that the district has. Marquez is a parishioner at San Miguel Archangel Catholic Church, where he has served on the church council, is involved with the Cursillo Ministry and Knights of Columbus, is a Eucharistic minister, and chaired the church's annual festival. Other community involvement includes serving as secretary of the Lee High School Football Booster Club, being a mentor at Bowie Fine Arts Academy, and was a member of the ad hoc committee for the new construction of Bunch Elementary. Marquez also knows more time is needed for an innovative district that has started partnerships with the Young Women's Preparatory Network, Idea Public Schools, and Third Future Schools. The thing about being innovative is, if you knew everything in the future, what was going to happen tomorrow, it would be an easy thing to do, Marquez said. As a board member, you can't say no when thinking about innovation. Student outcomes don't change until adult behaviors change, Marquez said. And just as education and systems change, so should education. NWS, Cooler Temperatures and Rain on the Way, by Stuart Doreen. The lowest temperatures since April are in the National Weather Service's forecast this week. The NWS is showing that an early fall is expected to arrive tonight when a front brings rain and a nearly 30-degree drop in high temperatures. The forecast specifically calls for gusts topping out at 35 miles an hour Tuesday night. Also blowing in is an 80% chance of rain. That is welcomed news for a community that is more than 4 inches below normal when it comes to rainfall this year. The front also is expected to bring on Wednesday the lowest high temperature since April 17th. A high of 63 is forecast, that is 26 degrees below normal for September 9th, and a dramatic change for Midland, which is coming off of one of the hottest summers in the city's history. The high temperature will remain in the 60s on Thursday before tracking higher Friday at 77 degrees, and into Saturday and Sunday the mid to upper 80s. The low temperature of 48 on Wednesday night also will be the lowest since mid-April. Lows the rest of the week are also expected to climb into the upper 50s and into the lower 60s. The chance of rain remains in the forecast Wednesday 50% and Thursday 40%. A chance of slight chance of rain remains in the forecast through Sunday. The National Weather Service reports the total amount of rain since April 1st has been 0.74 inches. The average rainfall from April 1st through September 7th is 8.16 inches. According to the National Weather Service, currently the city is in the midst of extreme drought conditions, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.